This new phenomenon, therefore, must be judged from three important points: whether it is actually the salvation from communism, quote-unquote, whether it actually functions, whether the people under the corporate state have gone forward or backward. Well, we're going to examine fascism as anti-Bolshevism, the clue of that, or the truth of that particular assertion, later in the broadcast, but we're going to begin by taking a look at the main features of fascist economics in Italy under Mussolini. We're going to take a look at some very important similarities, again, not exact analogies, but some very important similarities between the way Mussolini ran Italy and the way Ronald Reagan, first Ronald Reagan and now George Bush, have run the United States. Now, one of the most impressive and depressing similarities between the pro-business administration of Ronald Reagan and George Bush and that of Italy under Mussolini is the fact that, in spite of the enormous institutionalized corruption in both societies were kept afloat at least for a period of time. So far, the United States is still afloat, if you can call what's happening in February of 1990 afloat. The United States is still afloat, and Italy was kept afloat for a long period of time by basically mortgaging Italy to foreign lenders. Basically, the pumps, the economic pumps of Mussolini's Italy were primed by borrowing capital abroad. A tremendous amount of money was borrowed through the floating of bonds, primarily in the United States, and as a result, Mussolini ran huge budgetary deficits and mortgaged, literally mortgaged Italy to American lending institutions. Now, of Mussolini's borrowing of American capital, his mortgaging of Italy to American finance, and in turn, his use of this borrowed capital to build up the Italian military rather than Italian industry at the expense of the competitiveness of the Italian economy, similar to what's happening in the United States, George Seldes writes as follows in a book called Can These Things Be?, yet another of Seldes' many, many works. Can These Things Be? By George Seldes, was published in hardcover by... Well, it's copyright 1931, and it's published in hardcover by Brewer and Warren Incorporated, B-R-E-W-E-R and Warren Incorporated, long since vanished into the annals of American corporate history, no doubt. Now, of Mussolini's deficit financing, of his mortgaging of Italy to American finance, George Seldes writes as follows, and again, we're going to discuss some of the similarities between this and Reagan-Bush America in a minute. George Seldes writing in Can These Things Be? In order to carry on the myth of the balanced budget and the economic restoration of Italy, Mussolini has mortgaged Italy to American finance. American citizens now own about $500 million worth of Italy. Some of the principal borrowings, this list is not complete but is assuredly much longer, are Kingdom of Italy sevens. These are presumably the interest rates on the bond issues here. Kingdom of Italy sevens, $100 million, J.P. Morgan and Company. These are the financial institutions in this country which floated the loans. Kingdom, beginning once again, Kingdom of Italy sevens, $100 million, J.P. Morgan and Company. And again, bear in mind, a dollar worth much more in the 20s and 30s than it is now. City of Rome, six and a half, $30 million, J.P. Morgan and Company. City of Milan, six and a half, $20 million, Dillon Reed, Bankers Trust, and the Guarantee Trust. Credit Consortium Sevens, $10 million, Morgan, National City, and the First National. Adriatic Electric Sevens, $5 million, Blair and Company. Fiat Sevens, $10 million, Morgan. International Securities, $35 million, Alfred and Company, Harris Forbes, and Bankers Trust. Italian Public Utility Sevens, $20 million, Blair and Chase Securities. Lombard Electric Sevens, $6 million, Blair, Chase, Rollins and Company. Mendionali Electric Sevens, $10,250,000, Marshall Field, Glore Ward, Blythe, Wither and Company. Montecalini Mineral Sevens, $6 million, Guarantee Trust, Marshall Field, Glore Ward, International Acceptance Bank. Pirelli Sevens, $4 million, Morgan. United Electric Sevens, $5 million, Rollins and Blair. Then it also is listed here with no financial institutions after them. Private Credits, $25 million. SNIA Viscosa, $9 million. Electric Union, $6 million. Terni, $25 million. Adamello, $10 million. Isotta Frascini, $1,700,000. And the Rome Gas Company, $10 million. And Seldes goes on to comment, "And I am sure it will be a real pleasure to the Bolshevik-hating American public to know that a large part of the $500 million they put into Italy is being used to continue the black or anti-red terror. Perhaps it will be proud of the fact that American money is being used by Mussolini to create a fleet for the officially announced purpose of controlling the Mediterranean. What does this control mean? It means a war with England or France. Well, of course, later it was to mean a war with the United States as well. Worth noting here that as we saw in our Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast about U.S. industrial and financial support for Nazi Germany, American financial institutions help float the loans to get the capital to build the very Italian military which was to take the lives of American servicemen during World War II. Also worth noting very importantly for our purposes here that the temporary perceived success of Mussolini's Italy, such as it was accomplished again by mortgaging Italy to American finance. It should be noted here too that the money borrowed was plowed by Mussolini in considerable measure into the building of the military rather than industry, rather than into improving Italian municipalities and utilities. Much of it was used for building up the Italian military. Of course, Ronald Reagan's huge budget deficits stem from the enormous defense budgets and the tax cuts which accompanied them. And again, the United States so far under Reagan Bush has been kept afloat basically by floating bonds. Basically, our T-bills have kept the United States from going under so far. Basically, the Japanese, Germans, and other major investors have underwritten America's debt incurred in order to build up the American military rather than American industry, this, of course, placing the United States in a less competitive international position. And again, I'm not suggesting in any way that this is an exact analogy, but I am suggesting that it is an important and valid analogy, and one which, again, is very, very scary for our purposes here. Now, one of the main ways in which Mussolini was able to continue to secure those American loans was by portraying his corporate state as a success, whereas in fact it was not a success. We're going to go into now the economic mythology of the corporate state, how it was maintained, that is to say how that mythology was maintained, and in particular we're going to take a look at how the American press gave favorable coverage to Mussolini's corporate state, thereby serving to justify the investments of the American financial institutions who had floated the Italian bond issues, and also serving to justify the rationale behind the corporate state. Again, the American mainstream press covered for Mussolini and gave a coverage to Mussolini's Italy which was in defiance of the actual record, in defiance of the facts. Turning once again now to the book Sawdust Caesar, George Selde's landmark biography of Mussolini's Italy, we're going to take a look now at one of the major aspects of fraudulent fascist finance, and one of the major aspects in which I think Mussolini's corporate state is comparable in certain important respects to the America of Ronald Reagan and George Bush. Reading again from Sawdust Caesar, the he here, of course, is Mussolini, he flatly makes the statement that, quote, today we have a balanced budget. Self-ruling units, the provinces and the communes, have balanced their budgets too. Exports and imports and their relationships are carried on in a precise and definite rhythm, that of our stabilized lira. We're going to take a look at the economic mythology now of Mussolini's Italy. Specifically, we're going to take a look at the myth of the balanced budget in Italy. We're also going to take a look at the myth of favorable balances of trade in Italy. Another similar characteristic between Reagan-Bush America and Mussolini's Italy is that both the Italy of Mussolini and the America of Reagan and Bush have run huge trade deficits. But first, of the mythology of the balanced budget. And again, I'm not suggesting this is an exact analogy between Mussolini's Italy and contemporary America, but I do think that the budgetary chicanery, the cooking of the books, the budgetary BS here, the way in which Mussolini used blatantly fraudulent bookkeeping in order to make it appear as if his deficit financing actually had produced, or his state had produced, a balanced budget rather than huge budget deficits, this cooking of the books, this budgetary BS that Mussolini engaged in is, as I said, very similar to what the Bush administration and the Reagan administration before it have done in the United States. Of the budgetary chicanery of Mussolini and how it was used to justify the economic status quo, George Seldes writes as follows in Sawdust Caesar. In 1925, the first reports were sent from Rome that jugglery, trickery, and distorted official figures and statements have marked fascist finance. The Irish journalist and former diplomatic attaché in Rome, James Murphy, has published in the German, French, British, and American magazines numerous articles charging fraud which have never been challenged. He states, for instance, that the fascisti, to maintain confidence and goodwill abroad, especially among banking interests, have organized a system of propaganda about their economic position, have given to the public, quote, a state budget which has little or no relation to the real financial condition. It is simply a piece of propaganda. I should not make such a statement without being in a position to bring forward proof. Take Di Stefani's budget for 1923-24. For that year, I find that under one heading alone, there was an expenditure of 14 billion of lira, $700 million, not a cent of which is debited in the state budget. The expenditure was officially announced in the official gazette. It figures in the treasury accounts, but it is carefully kept out of the budget that has been published. That sum alone would practically consume the whole income from taxation for the same year. Therefore, De Stefani's first budget had really a much heavier deficit than those of his predecessors, even if we confine the deficit to the above expenditure and say nothing of other treasury debts incurred. To keep all such questions dark, the press is muzzled, and foreign journalists are watched and persecuted lest they begin to pry into the question of Italy's finances. By such means, and by the expenditure of huge sums for propaganda abroad, the fascists think that they will be able to stave off the day when their real economic and financial position may become known to foreign bankers and foreign industrialists, unquote. Mr. Murphy likewise questions both Mussolini and American bankers on the subject of balanced budget by the municipalities. Quote, one of the immediate purposes of the dictatorship obtaining control of the municipalities, he declares, is the facilitation of fascism's shady finance. It is well known that a favorite trick practiced since Mussolini got control of things is to falsify the state budget by transferring state expenses to the municipal budgets. All the municipal budgets show a deficit, but this does not appear in public. And there will be no chance of its coming into the light now when there will be no local supervisors appointed by the people. The system will be understood if we imagine all the municipalities as subordinate corporations grouped under the one parent corporation, which is the state. The balance sheets of the subordinate corporations are being thrown more and more into a state of insolvency in order to make the parent balance sheet look healthy. Yet the parent corporation is solely dependent on the solvency of all the subordinated corporations taken together. American financiers who have visited Italy have been too simple-minded to spot this trick. They have also been too simple-minded to ask for the treasury accounts and collate them with the budget. And so the fascist financial bluff has gone ahead triumphantly. Mussolini wants to show the unwary Yankee how splendidly everything is going in Italy so that he can raise loans in the United States, unquote. To such general statements must be added the official figures from the fascist government's publications. The debts of the provinces as of January 1, 1925 are 954 million, and January 1, 1928, 1,326 million, while the debts of the capital cities of the provinces are as follows. January 1, 1925, 3,066 million. January 1, 1928, 5,481 million. Increase in debt, 2,415 million lira. Which somehow does not agree with Mussolini's statement that, quote, the provinces and the communes have balanced their budgets too, unquote. Fascist Italy, say European economists, is the only country in the world which announces balanced budgets while showing deficits in the treasury. Perhaps they would change, or Seldes would change that assessment, as would the European economists, had they had the opportunity to view contemporary America. Of the mythology of Mussolini's favorable balance of trade, which was accomplished, again, through assessing Italians abroad very, very expensive remittances, of the fascist fraud of a favorable balance of trade, Seldes writes as follows. Again, from Sawdust Caesar. The American commercial attaché, H.C. McLean, reported from Rome on January 16, 1928, that, quote, the outstanding characteristic of Italy's relations with the rest of the world is the large excess of the country's merchandise imports over its merchandise exports, a condition prevailing for many years. To compensate the large adverse trade balance in visible terms, notably remittances from Italians resident abroad and expenditures of foreign tourists in Italy, must be largely depended upon, unquote. The attaché then points out an adverse trade balance of almost 5 billion lira for the first 10 months of 1927, adding, quote, having accepted 5 billion as Italy's adverse trade balance and 1 billion 500 million as its net outgo on financial transactions, we have a total of 6,500 million lira, for which compensation must be found on the credit side of the country's international accounts. He then shows that emigrants' remittances have sharply declined. Whereas in 1926, the withdrawals from postal savings banks were practically compensated by new deposits, during the first 10 months of 1927, such withdrawals exceeded deposits by no less than 570 million lira. So again, the fraudulent aspects of Mussolini's claims for a favorable balance of trade here set forth by Seldes. Now, one of the major points of this broadcast is that the mainstream American press, acting in concert with the perceived interests of corporate America, I guess you could say, continued to parrot the various aspects of corporate mythology, of the mythology of Mussolini's corporate state, and they fell right into line with the propagation of the myth, and we've just seen what a myth that is, of Mussolini's balanced budget. Seldes writes as follows of the American press's parroting of the mythology of the balanced budget in Sawdust Caesar. It was nothing short of a miracle. The sun of economic fatality stood still in the heavens at the command of the prophet, and the American international bond floaters sang the epic of the great deed as they issued $600 million in loans to Italy. $600 million American dollars is a sum. It was surely worth the employment of public relations counsel with the aid of the banking houses in protecting it. Time after time, between 1925 and 1929, the American public dumped the Italian bonds back on the market, and each time the dozen houses which floated them intensified their campaign, which created the Mussolini balanced budget myth, while they threatened the banking and brokerage firms which represented them with cutting them off from participation in future business if they failed to dispose of the Italian goods. The Duce, of course, has always been party to the financial myth-making. He declared the stabilization at 19 was approved by, quote, profound experts in financial questions. That's the stabilization of the lira, which turned out to be a disaster. But it was later proven that Finance Minister Volpe and his good friend Andrew W. Mellon had advised against that figure. It was always the head of the government who struck the note for the orchestra of the press to follow. When the bankers and the press agents and the Italians who wrote for the Associated Press and the American newspapers reported the stabilization at 19 to the dollar of victory, that Bolshevism threatened in 1922, that the budgets had balanced, that the municipalities were out of the red, literally and figuratively, and that prosperity had crowned the planned economy of fascism up to 1929, they are but playing variations on the tune which the master musician originated. That last sentence again. When the bankers and the press agents and the Italians who wrote for the Associated Press and the American newspapers reported the stabilization at 19 to the dollar of victory, that Bolshevism threatened in 1922, that the budgets had balanced, that the municipalities were out of the red literally and figuratively, and that prosperity had crowned the planned economy of fascism up to 1929, they are but playing variations on the tune which the master musician originated. And as we're going to see here, the continued perpetuation of the economic and political mythology of the corporate state was a major occupation of the American press during that period. We're going to take another short musical break, and we're going to come back to taking a look at just how Mussolini and the American press propagated the myth of an improvement in the lifestyle of the average Italian under fascism, whereas in fact, the standard of living of the average Italian plummeted under fascism, unless, of course, you were one of the main backers of Mussolini's party. We're next going to approach another aspect of the economic mythology of Mussolini's corporate state, and specifically, we're going to take a look at how Mussolini propagated the myth that his corporate state improved the standard of living of the average Italian. In fact, the standard of living for the average Italian worker, as might be expected, plummeted under fascism. Mussolini misrepresented that, and once again, we're going to see the pattern of the American press covering basically for Mussolini, perpetuating the lie that Mussolini first generated concerning the myth of the improvement of the standard of living for the average Italian. Returning once again to Sawdust Caesar by George Seldes, of the myth of the improvement of the Italian lifestyle under Mussolini. However, the only important thing for us to consider is whether, functioning or not as a corporate state, the fascist system of planned economy, the substitute for the planned economy of Bolshevism, has or has not achieved anything up to date. It is Mussolini who said that the state's ultimate goal is, quote, the well-being of the Italian people, unquote. It must be, quote, judged and measured directly by the masses as instruments through which these masses may improve their standard of living. Someday the worker, the tiller of the soil, will say to himself and to others, quote, if today I am better off practically, I owe it to the institutions which the fascist revolution has created, unquote. Interrupting here briefly, that reminds me in a way of the campaign slogan that Reagan used for his second campaign in 1984. Basically, the Reagan Revolution asked the question about whether or not, basically they asked the American electorate to consider whether or not you're better off than you were 4 years ago. Again, I'm not suggesting this is a precise analogy, but it's similar. Again, Mussolini writing here, someday the worker, the tiller of the soil, will say to himself and to others, quote, if today I am better off practically, I owe it to the institutions which the fascist revolution has created, unquote. In just this manner, let the following facts pass judgment. This again is Seldes writing. In 1926, when the few untrammeled journalists reported that there was already a crisis in fascist economics and that the publicly announced balanced budgets were mere jugglery, official figures showed that wages were below 1921 and that the cost of living had gone up 30%. In 1927, with the stabilization of the lira, Mussolini found a much more serious economic crisis. He therefore announced a reduction in rentals, reduction in the price of manufactured goods, and a wage cut throughout the nation of between 5 and 20%. He promised that the cuts ordered in the high cost of living would more than recompense the reductions in salary. At that time, the general price index was 670, wages stood at 585. In real wages, the workman was 13% worse off than before the war. That fascism had proved a failure so far as the working population of Italy is concerned long before the world crisis of 1929-35 is openly admitted in the 1932 report of the Secretary of State for Corporations, who wrote, quote, between June 1927 and December 1928, the wages of industrial workers have gone down by about 20%, and a further reduction of 10% was made in 1929. During 1930, there has been a general reduction varying for the different categories of workers from 18 to 25%. Many other adjustments have been realized in 1931, unquote. But that is not all. The decree effective December 1, 1930, cut the salaries of those earning more than $3,000 a year by 35% and those below $2,000 by 12%, and wages of 300 lira, $15.70, to 1,000 lira, $52.35 a month, 8%, and those above 1,000 lira, 10%. This cut affected 1 million laborers in the industrial centers of the North, Milan, Turin, and Genoa. The government announced it hoped, unquote, to reduce prices of commodities accordingly. Skipping down, and George Seldes next writes not only about the decline of the Italian standard of living under Mussolini for most people, that is, of course, unless you were one of his main fascist backers, but he talks about how the American press continued to misrepresent what was actually a decline in the Italian standard of living or in the standard of living for the average Italian, and this was misrepresented as gains by the American press. Again, the same sort of perpetuation of the economic mythology of Mussolini's corporate state that we looked at vis-a-vis the balanced budget. To complete the chronicle, it was announced by Mussolini on December 11, 1934, that a nationwide and simultaneous reduction in salaries and the cost of living was being worked out, which directly affected every person in the kingdom, directly and indirectly, the cut being similar to that of October 1930, and similarly carrying with it a reduction in cost of rent, light, heat, food, and transport of between 10 and 12%. But instead of mentioning the obvious collapse of the fascist economy, the American press heralded each of these seven events with an appropriate excuse furnished by the fascist propaganda department. The headlines, for example, said that the 1927 cut was due to the success of the stabilization on a gold basis. In 1933, Mr. Cortese of the Times supplied a story which was headed, quote, Italy cuts wages to aid recovery, unquote. The first 1934 reduction was linked with one in Russia, and the joint headline read, Russia and Italy slash payrolls in economy wave, unquote. The second 1934 cut was reported by the Times as, quote, Italy to slash wages and cost of living to meet competition of non-gold nations. So once again, we see the perpetuation by the American news media of the mythology of Mussolini's corporate state. And obviously, at least until the extent of the fraud became evident, this served the interests of those American lending institutions which had helped finance Mussolini's deficits, and in turn those American corporate interests that saw Mussolini's corporate state as a positive phenomenon. Now, as indicated earlier in the broadcast, one of the main selling points for fascism. One of the main selling points of the corporate state is that it was represented as the antidote to Bolshevism. At the end of World War I, as I mentioned, they were successful in the Soviet Union and unsuccessful in other countries, communist uprisings, and this panicked many of the world's top industrialists and financiers, who then turned to fascism as the antidote to the perceived threat of Bolshevism. Now, although the American press, as well as Mussolini himself, represented fascism as the reason why the abortive socialist uprising in Italy failed, in point of fact, other political and economic factors produced the decline in the popularity of Marxism among the Italian workers. And beyond that, Mussolini himself admitted that fascism was not the reason why Bolshevism failed in Italy. It was not fascism that turned Bolshevism away. Bolshevism was already on decline. It was already in decline due to a number of independent factors, fascism not being among them. Mussolini himself even admitted this in an editorial. This is covered by George Seldes in Sawdust Caesar as follows. To begin with, it must be said that despite the best American public relations counsel employed by the international bankers, despite the newspapers and magazines which voluntarily surrendered to the fascist propaganda machine, it is an historic fact that the whole Mussolini-Bolshevik story was a pure myth which dates from the time of the foreign loans, and the most important historian who first admitted that the Bolshevism of 1920, the worst year, the time of the occupation of factories, had disappeared long before the victory of fascism, wrote in 1921, quote, "The Italy of 19... Now, by the way, this is Mussolini himself writing in an editorial here. "The Italy of 1921 is fundamentally different from that of 1919. It has been said and demonstrated several times. Fascism must not have the air of monopolizing for itself the right of such a profound national change. It is enough to count fascism among the forces the most powerful and the most disciplined which have operated in that direction. After having thus limited our merit, there is no man or party which can attack us. To say that the Bolshevik danger still exists in Italy is equivalent in trying to exchange, for reasons of self-interest, fear against the truth. Bolshevism is conquered. More than that, it has been disowned by the leaders and by the people." This editorial is signed by Benito Mussolini. Basically, Mussolini admitting that by 1921, before his march on Rome, Bolshevism was in decline. But in spite of the fact that even Mussolini himself, although he was later to trumpet fascism again as the antidote to Bolshevism, despite the fact that Mussolini himself admitted that this was not the case, again, the American press, the American news media, continued to parrot the official Mussolini line of fascism as the effective antidote to Bolshevism. Seldes writes of this as follows. "But popular opinion, and the bankers, needed a St. George and therefore refused to accept St. George's own admission that there was no Bolshevik dragon for him to kill in 1922. Popular opinion, therefore, finds consolation in those American economists, literateur, and philosophers of the daily press and weeklies which boast readers by the millions. One of these writers states that ruin impended. Mussolini took the short and unconstitutional cut, which is the dictatorial way. He smashed precedents, turned red terror into white fear, and brought order and, what was even more important, economic revival out of the dust and din of class war and political bicker."
All righty, you're listening to the KFJC Memorial Day weekend, Uncle Sam and the Swastika Special, dealing with the cooperation between American corporations and the fascist powers of World War II. This is a Memorial Day weekend special, and you are listening to the Uncle Sam and Il Duce archive show, recorded on February 18th. Of 1990. We're going to go directly to the next side, the concluding side of Uncle Sam and Il Duce. It is about 10 more minutes on one side that I'm going to play, and then we're going to continue with this forced march. Not a march on Rome, but I guess you could say perhaps a march on Los Altos Hills or on the Silicon Valley. And after the story of Uncle Sam and Il Duce, I'm going to play a half-hour segment recorded in February of 1995 called Il Martello, about how American fascists precipitated the deep sixing of a small Italian language newspaper for Italian Americans that was opposed to Mussolini. This particular article that you're going to hear was written by H.L. Mencken, the famous H.L. Mencken, in 1925. But before that, the concluding 10 minutes of Uncle Sam and Il Duce. This next segment is obviously 10 minutes in length. Those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. 3, 2, 1, here we go.
But in spite of the fact that even Mussolini himself, although he was later to trumpet fascism again as the antidote to Bolshevism, despite the fact that Mussolini himself admitted that this was not the case, Again, the American press, the American news media, continued to parrot the official Mussolini line of fascism as the effective antidote to Bolshevism. Seldes writes of this as follows. But popular opinion, and the bankers, needed a St. George and therefore refused to accept St. George's own admission that there was no Bolshevik dragon for him to kill in 1922. Popular opinion, therefore, finds consolation in those American economists, literateur, and philosophers of the daily press and weeklies which boast readers by the millions. One of these writers states that ruin impended. Mussolini took the short and unconstitutional cut, which is the dictatorial way. He smashed precedents, turned red terror into white fear, and brought order, and, what was even more important, economic revival out of the dust and din of class war and political bicker. In the last analysis, fascism is not only a political force of historic moment, but it has been the impetus of an impressive commercial renaissance as well. This same political economist precedes this statement with an unqualified declaration that, quote, the traditional parliamentary systems of Europe are failures, unquote, and a suggestion that France should join the dictatorships. It is true that the same writer in 1938 all his praise of dictatorships, but he remained the agent of the Italian Bolshevik myth. He wrote, quote, Sovietization, with its attendant social and fiscal dislocation, impended. The workers had seized the factories and all the important productive centers. Chaos loomed. In the darkest hour, a strong man rose up and saved the day. The stern will of Mussolini, reinforced by the cohort of black shirts, imposed a regime that made for historic rehabilitation. Dictatorship achieved its best. Another writer, a more flowery one, believes that, quote, everybody who has looked into the fascist movement in Italy has agreed that it was a greatly needed movement and that it saved the nation from descending into a chaotic whirlpool of communism and a financial disaster that would have made Niagara's whirlpool look like a placid puddle of rainwater in comparison. This is, incidentally, the same historian who glorifies Cesare Rosso as the hero who defends the castor oil treatment and who tells Americans that, quote, in spite of his, Mussolini's, many changes, there has never been a word uttered against his absolute sincerity and honesty, unquote, and that, quote, Mussolini's dictatorship is a good dictatorship, unquote. Again, although it's not a precise analogy, that reminds me in some ways of former Reagan UN Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick's distinction between totalitarian regimes, i.e. dictatorial socialist regimes, which she condemned, and authoritarian regimes, i.e. dictatorial right-wing regimes, which she, in effect, condoned. She distinguished between the totalitarians and the authoritarians. And again, in traditionally, America has found right-wing dictators a good deal more palatable than left-wing dictators, even desirable. The last aspect of the mythology of Mussolini's Italy that we're going to look at here concerns one of the least important and perhaps the best known of the many pieces of mythology propagated about Mussolini's Italy, namely the myth that Mussolini made the Italian trains run on time. In the first place, it should be commented that the notion that Mussolini made the trains run on time is due to a couple of things. First of all, a misunderstanding of Italian history, and also, I think, to a certain extent, anti-Latin bias. People have been made familiar with Italian jokes and the notion that somehow to be Italian is to be incompetent. That, I suspect, is an aspect to the view that Mussolini made the Italian trains run on time. Also, it should be noted that the Italian rail system did undergo tremendous dislocation during the First World War, because basically priority was given to routing troop and munition trains to the front. This caused tremendous dislocation in the Italian rail system. Now, the regime that followed the First World War and that preceded Mussolini, the liberal regime, basically undertook a five-year program to successfully restore the Italian rail system, which it did. Mussolini then took credit for that, and by giving priority to the express trains, which the tickets for which were more expensive and which were patronized by foreign journalists and dignitaries, by giving priority to the express trains, he actually decreased the service on some of the lower-priced lines. So the Mussolini not only didn't make the Italian trains run on time, the disruption from the First World War in the Italian rail system was accomplished by the liberal regime, but in fact by routing the express trains, which were frequented by foreign journalists and dignitaries, over the other trains, the lower-priced trains, which were patronized by most Italians, he basically screwed the rail system up somewhat from what it had been. And again, I mention this not because in and of itself it's a significant detail, it's perhaps one of the most minor aspects of Mussolini's Italy, but it's one of the aspects that has survived most durably. One always hears about how Mussolini made the trains run on time. Well, he didn't. That also was a piece of mythology, one tragically that has survived, and we're going to go over that right now. Of the mythology, or of the myth, I should say, of Mussolini making the Italian trains run on time, George Seldes writes as follows in Sawdust Caesar. Least important and most quoted is the argument that the trains run on time. The vast American tourist class, which includes bankers, editors, senators, and representatives, mayors and mayoresses, army officers, and just plain folks, quote-unquote, return to its native land where railroading is an accepted institution but not necessarily a yardstick for patriotism and roared in unison, "Great is the Duce. The trains now run on time," unquote. A poor, simple, naive minority which protested that some abstract and old-fashioned American things such as liberty of the press, freedom of the individual, equal justice, and the spread of culture were being slaughtered by the corporate state, where an institution known as the OVRA exercised dictatorial terrorism, was squelched with a complete answer, quote, "But the trains run on time," unquote. When the unruly minority timidly suggested that the authoritarian state was the complete antithesis of the Magna Carta, the Declaration of Independence, and the Rights of Man, millions of tourists would leap up to chant the litany, "The trains run on time," unquote. The official press agents and the official philosophers of the fascist regime explained to the world that the running of trains was the symbol of the restoration of law and order. Order, discipline, hierarchy. No one has bothered to explain that the short period of railroad disorganization occurred just after the war when Italy, in order to keep the troop and supply trains running, tore up the rails in many parts of the kingdom and was forced to neglect roadbeds and repair work everywhere, and that immediately after the war engaged upon a railroad reconstruction program of 5 years, which resulted in June of 1922 with enough success to, quote, "make the trains run on time," unquote. A claim of the liberal regime. The liberal regime thoughtlessly hired no press agent and no international bankers to publicize itself. Skipping down. Do the railroads always run on time under fascist discipline? By the way, I should interrupt to say that Mussolini stationed armed fascisti on all of the trains to help motivate the railroad employees, also to keep them from striking. Again, resuming Seldes' narrative. Do the railroads always run on time under fascist discipline? An investigation during a fortnight in July of 1930 made, despite the fact that the press was forbidden to mention railroad accidents and delays, disclosed 5 cases. The Milan-Chiasso Express was derailed at Saragano, 2 of the crew being injured. 2 days later, the train carrying the Honorable Minister of Justice Rocco was derailed and arrived many hours late. On July 22nd, the Rome-Milan-Pullman was derailed at Targuini. On the 26th, the locomotive and 14 coaches fell into the Maduna River near Udine, and there was one other derailment of small importance. It is true that the majority of big expresses, those carrying eyewitnessing tourists, are usually put through on time. But on the smaller lines, bad rail and bad road conditions frequently cause delays. Wrote Monsieur van der Velde, noted Belgian foreign minister, after a trip to Italy, quote, "The time is no more when Italian trains run on time. We always were kept waiting for more than a quarter of an hour at the level crossings because the trains were never there at the times they should have been passing," unquote. So again, yet another piece of mythology of Mussolini's corporate state. It should be...
We're going to go directly to the Il Martello section. We've got a lot of tapes, by the way. That was the conclusion of the actual discussion. There was a bit of rumination about American journalists and how they tend to stick to their hotels and are not necessarily the best reporters, at least foreign reporters. That is, however, the entire main body of the Uncle Sam and Il Duce program, subtitled American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State. This was recorded on February 18th of 1990. Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. You're listening to the KFJC Month of Mayhem Memorial Day Weekend Special, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, the story of American corporations and their support for the fascist powers of World War II. We're going to go directly to a half-hour segment entitled Il Martello. This was recorded in the fall of 1995, and it is drawn from the work of the famed American journalist H.L. Mencken. Those of you who are taping, this is a half-hour in length. 3, 2, 1. Here we go.
Hello, my name's Dave Emery.
Welcome once again to our discussions of international fascism, elements of the U.S. national security establishment, and relations between same. What we're going to do this evening is to step back in time, and by way of underscoring the deep relationship between elements of the American industrial and financial elite and the powers of international fascism, we're going to discuss an incident which is has been forgotten, and which yet at the same time is very significant for the information that it has to yield about just how sympathetic many of our industrialists and financiers were to the powers of fascism, and beyond that, the extent to which the American political and legal systems were made to bend to the will of those pro-fascist industrialist financiers, as well as political and military figures, and some jurists as well. There is a miscellaneous archive show available from Archives on Audio called Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State. In that particular program, I discuss a comparison between the American economy under Ronald Reagan and George Bush and Mussolini's corporate state in Italy. Beyond that, I also underscore the fact that not only was Mussolini propped up by American capital, but in turn, the American journalistic community covered up for the many drastic shortcomings of Mussolini's corporate state. What we're going to look at today is the ramifications of the American support for Mussolini for an Italian-American who was publishing an Italian-language newspaper in New York City for Italian-Americans. This newspaper, this publisher, was called Carlo Tresca, T-R-E-S-C-A, and he was the proprietor of a small paper in New York City called Il Martello. That's M-A-R-T-E-L-L-O. Il Martello was very critical of Mussolini, and at a dinner making a member of the board of directors of U.S. Steel an honorary fascisti, the Italian ambassador to the United States made it very clear that he did not think much of this newspaper and its criticism of Italy. And we're going to examine not only that, but we're going to examine what followed. We're going to examine the extraordinary treatment that was accorded Carlo Tresca and Il Martello. We're going to examine the ultimate putting out of business of Il Martello and the jailing of Carlo Tresca. This because his newspaper carried a two-line advertisement for a book on birth control. That advertisement had actually been placed by a fellow named Nieri, and he had operated in turn with the advertising agent for Il Martello, a fellow named Vela. Despite that, Carlo Tresca was given over a year in a federal penitentiary in Atlanta, now a notoriously harsh federal prison, probably much worse in the 1920s than it is now. Research credit on the following article goes to a listener. This particular article comes from a book called The Impossible H.L. Mencken, edited by Marion Elizabeth Rogers, R-O-D-G-E-R-S, and it was published by Anchor Books in New York City in 1991. What we're going to hear is a reading of an article entitled The Land of the Free. This article was written, of course, by the famous H.L. Mencken, social critic, and a very witty and acerbic one he was. H.L. Mencken wrote this particular article, The Land of the Free, for the Baltimore Sun, a major urban daily, obviously, on January 12th of 1925. So we're going to be jumping back a little over 70 years in time. The article, again, from the book The Impossible H.L. Mencken, edited by Marion Elizabeth Rogers, Anchor Books, New York City, copyright 1991. The article The Land of the Free by H.L. Mencken, 112-25, Baltimore Sun. It reads, Carlo Tresca is the proprietor of a small Italian paper in New York by the name of Il Martello. He runs to liberal ideas, and when the fascisti came into power in his native country, and began Ku Kluxing their opponents, he denounced them in his paper and called upon the Italians in America to repudiate them. His articles were vigorously written and quickly attracted attention. A great many Italians began to incline toward his views. That was early in 1923. In July of the same year, certain persons in New York gave a public dinner to Judge Elbert H. Gary, G-A-R-Y, chairman of the board of directors of the United States Steel Corporation. Judge Gary, for his services to the cause of humanity in America, had been made an honorary member of the fascisti organization, and one of the guests who came to dinner to do him honor was Prince Gelesto Caetani, C-A-E-T-A-N-I, then
and now the Italian ambassador in Washington, interrupting, of course, when the Serbic H.L. Mencken says that he was awarded, became an honorary member of the Fascisti because of his services to humanity. He's being sarcastic. Again, note in the miscellaneous archive show available from Archives on Audio entitled Uncle Sam and Il Duce, the profound American capital and political and journalistic support for Mussolini is detailed, accessing the landmark work of George Seldes.